dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 641 of Unwelcome Guests, the making of the national security state. I'm Robin Upton, and it's a fairly crowded show this week because there's about 2 hours 20 of film that I had to condense and adapt into 2 hours. I've trimmed bits where the content was largely visual and added some subtitle readings and explanatory notes where the visual content was particularly important. And thanks to Scott Noble for giving us a great summary of the role of fiction of the Cold War in the rise and rise of the national security state. Last week we were looking particularly at the way in which the dogma of Cold War and Reds Under the Bed served to cover for colonial exploitation. This week we're looking at the impact of the Cold War within the US, how the spectre of imminent thermonuclear destruction was used, amongst other threats, to keep people under control. We resume with Nancy Snow, author of Democracy, Inc., speaking about socialism for the rich, the rugged capitalism for the poor.
Who pays for it? But we do. You know, the taxpayers pay for it. So when a worker makes a mistake on an assembly line, the worker pays for it. He might lose his job, or maybe will get demoted. But that's an individual result, whereas, you know, at the business level, this is all part of kind of feeding into these American ideals of who we are. The business sector or the military sector, they often work very much interlocked, and there's still no other country on the planet that is so militarized as ours is the United States. It's really kind of almost this sleeper effect, and it's often what we say about sort of propaganda, you know, the fish isn't aware of the water surrounding it. It's the same thing with this military, this pro-military, pro-business type of mentality that we have, almost knee-jerk support, in that it's our surround sound, and we're just not aware of anything that's really countering that surround sound. So the Eisenhower statement,
military-industrial complex,
is just, again, a continuation of the rise of the corporate sector. And the rise of the corporate sector in the 20th century is probably the most, if I were doing a top 10 list of propaganda events, that would be at the very top. And we see it now. Its tentacles have really just taken over through into entertainment, into virtually every sector of our society, including education. We've had a corporatization of education, so that what results is that in everything you do, there has to be a bottom line effect to it. You know, what's the profit from this? How can we profit from this? I think once we had declared a Cold War, we often then try to make the building blocks that will sort of support this continuation. What you have happen is a lot of people will show up with their own vested interests in this industry. It's almost like any industry. It could be the fashion industry, entertainment industry. This is a war industry.
Trident 1, a powerful new three-stage missile with a range of 4,000 nautical miles, capable of delivering multiple warheads to widely scattered targets.
Someday, jet aeroplanes will be invisible to radar waves.
Imagine man-made moons helping us to communicate.
Tomorrow, electronic highways in the sky will guide air travelers safely to their destination.
Year after year, Lockheed Martin takes the most amazing ideas about the future and makes them fly.
The new system of perpetual war, would create economic growth, but a special kind of economic growth. Instead of developing more extensive social programs, the government would use tax dollars to enrich the already rich. At the same time, America would become a full-fledged empire. CIA whistleblower John Stockwell would describe the Cold War enemy as follows. Far more Catholics than communists, far more Buddhists than communists. Most of them couldn't give you an intelligent definition of communism or of capitalism.
John Stockwell, former CIA station chief.
My expertise, as you know, is CIA, Marine Corps, three CIA secret wars. I had a position in the National Security Council in 1975 as the chief of the Angola task force running the secret war in Angola. It was the third CIA secret war I was part of. The national security law creating the National Security Council and the CIA, as you know, was passed in 1947. The CIA was given this charter to perform such other duties and function as might be necessary to the national security interests, and given a vague authority to protect its sources and methods. And I think it was in the mid-80s that I coined this phrase, the Third World War, because in my research I realized that we were not attacking the Soviet Union and the CIA's activities. We were attacking people in the Third World. And I'm going to just quickly, in the interest of time, just give you a little sense of what that means, this Third World War. Basically, it's the third, I believe, in terms of loss of life and human destruction, the third bloodiest war in all of history. They undertake to run operations in every corner of the globe. They also undertook the license of operating just totally above and beyond U.S. laws. They had a license, if you will, to kill, but also they took that to a license to smuggle drugs, a license to do all kinds of things to other people in other societies in violation of international law, our law, and every principle of nations working together for a healthier and more peaceful world. Meanwhile, again, they battled to convert the U.S. legal system in such a way that it would give them control of our society. Now, we have massive documentation of what they call the secret wars of the CIA. We don't have to guess or speculate. We had the Church Committee investigate them in 1975, gave us our first really in-depth, powerful look inside this structure. Senator Church said in the 14 years before he did his investigation that he found they had run 900 major operations and 3,000 minor operations. And if you extrapolate that over the whole period of the 40-odd years that we've had a CIA, you come up with 3,000 major operations and over 10,000 minor operations. Every one of them illegal, every one of them disruptive of the lives and societies of other peoples, and many of them bloody and gory beyond comprehension almost. Extensively, we manipulated and organized the overthrow of functioning constitutional democracies in other countries. We organized secret armies and directed them to fight in just about every continent in the world. We encouraged ethnic minorities to rise up and fight, people like the Mosquito Indians in Nicaragua, the Kurds in the Middle East, the Hmongs in Southeast Asia. We have organized, and we still do, and fund death squads in countries around the world, like the Treasury Police in El Salvador, which are responsible for most of the killing of the 50,000 people just in the 80s, and there was 70,000 before that. Trying to summarize this Third World War that the CIA, the U.S. National Security Complex, with the military all interwoven in it in many different ways, has been waging. Let me just put it this way. The best heads that I coordinate with studying this thing, we count at least, minimum figure, 6 million people who've been killed in this long 40-year war that we've waged against the people of the Third World. These are not Soviets. We have not been parachuting teams into the Soviet Union to kill and hurt and maim people, especially not since 1954 when they developed actually a capability of dropping atomic weapons on the United States. These are all people of the Third World. They're people of countries like the Congo, Vietnam, Kampuchea, Indonesia, Nicaragua, where conspicuously they nor their governments do not have the capability of doing any physical hurt to the United States. They don't have ICBMs. They don't have armies or navies. They could not hurt us if they wanted to. There has rarely been any evidence that they really wanted to. And that, in fact, is perhaps the whole point. If they had had ICBMs, we probably wouldn't have done the things to them for fear of retaliation. Cheap shots, if you will, killing people of other countries of the world who cannot defend themselves under the guise of secrecy and under the rubric of national security.
I'm John Wayne. Is there any better or equal hope in the world, Lincoln asked, than the ultimate justice of the people? We Americans believe there is not. The stonework of our national life is made of this belief. We believe in many things, but this belief that man is a responsible being bears out our own unique stamp as a nation.
Michael Parenti, historian.
Imperialism is the process of empire. It's more than just dominion and control. Imperialism is when the dominant interests of the empire country go out and they expropriate the land, the natural resources, the labor, and the markets of another country for the benefit of the rich of the imperial country, and sometimes for the benefit of a collaborating, controlling class in the colonized country. Imperialism today no longer means direct colonization. You have what's called neo-imperialism, which involves not taking over the country and planting your flag and conquering it, but involves simply moving in and dominating its
William
economic
I.
and
Robinson,
political life.
William I. Robinson, editor of Critical Globalization Studies.
The fundamental contradiction in world society over the last few centuries has been between the haves and the have-nots. It's been between a dispossessed majority in the world, disproportionately concentrated in the third world, in the former colonized world, and the powerful states and the elites that benefit and control those powerful states in this world system. And depending on what moment in the last few centuries we've been talking about, there's always been one or another way in which that contradiction has been ideologically framed. So it was ideologically framed as the manifest destiny, the superiority of the Anglo-Saxon race and its destiny to rule the world before there was any such thing as communism or the Soviet Union. Then it was framed as anarchists that are going to create an anarchic society before the Soviet Union came into existence. During the Cold War, the principal way in which the war of the rich and powerful against the poor majority of the world was framed was a struggle against communism. Then the Cold War comes to an end, and it's a struggle against international drug trafficking. And then we have 9/11, and now the principal lines of battle are ideologically expressed as a war against terrorism. So there's been one or another justification or legitimation for the domination of a small minority of humanity over a majority of humanity. What has not changed is that system of domination. What has changed is how it is justified and legitimated. The U.S. has intervened. Coup d'etats have taken place. Wars of intervention have unfolded before, during, and after the Cold War. So we cannot attribute the nature of this global system to a mid-20th century battle between a communist and a capitalist system.
Russ Baker, journalist.
A lot of people seem to think that American imperialism is of recent vintage, but actually it goes way, way back. You can argue that it goes back at least certainly to the Spanish-American War and the takeover of the Philippines, Cuba, and Puerto Rico. But you can also find it going much further back, really its roots perhaps in the Monroe Doctrine. By the 1920s, we see an article in The Nation magazine called the Republic of Brown Brothers, and this was about a bank that would later be, one of its partners would be Prescott Bush, the grandfather of George W. Bush, and how they were using the U.S. government, particularly, for example, the military, the Marines, what have you, to go into various countries where the financial interests of private corporations were threatened and essentially neutralize or even remove governments. So there's a long, long history of this. Always, we are being told, serving the interests of the American people. Questionable whether it's serve the interests of these corporations always.
Again, we can go back to Haiti. The best example was historically has been Haiti. History of Haiti is the history of the world capitalist system. You study what's happened in Haiti, you study the struggle of the Haitian people, and you've studied the history of humanity for the last 500 years. Haiti, what is today the country of Haiti, was the first country that Columbus touched down in and conquered. And again, the conquest of 1492 and on, which was initiated by Columbus, opened up this era of world capitalism that we've gone through now for the last 519 years. And very quickly, the indigenous in Haiti were completely eliminated. In utter genocide, the indigenous basically disappeared from Haiti, and the Spanish began to import African slaves to run sugar plantations, which now spread all over the island of Haiti. Later on, France and Spain competed for control over Haiti. The French kicked out the Spanish and turned Haiti into this gem of its colonial system. The vast majority of the wealth of France was now generated by 400,000 slaves in Haiti, run by a few thousand slave masters. So the Haitians revolt. The Haitian slaves begin an uprising in 1793. In 1802, they successfully kick out the French colonialists, set up the first independent and free republic in the Americas. I say independent and free because the United States sets up an independent republic in 1776, but not a free one, one based on slavery. In half of this of the U.S. Republic. And as a result of setting up an independent and free republic on the basis of the one successful slave rebellion in the Americas, the powers that be in the world capitalist system unleash on Haiti terror and misery and punishment the likes the world has never seen.
Jean-Bertrand Aristide, speaking in 1985. We feel that Haiti's historic handlebars are in our hands. It's like a two-wheeled bike, and we're the ones steering it. The corrupt always want us to turn the bicycle this way, to the right. This will make us even more miserable, so we fall into the abyss. But we say no to this, and we say yes to the left movement, which we don't have now.
In 1986, the Haitian people have another uprising. This is almost 300 years after their first uprising against slavery, and they throw out Baby Doc, and after a series of fits and bouts, there's free elections held in 1990. The person that wins those elections is Aristide. And Aristide begins to transform these structures that have been molded over nearly 500 years, these structures of colonialism, these structures of economic backwardness, these structures of domination. And what's the result? The army stages a coup d'etat with the support of the United States and of France and the other great powers in the world. And Aristide is forced to flee. He comes back in 1994. He's not allowed to really make any of the substantive changes that he was trying to make. He finishes up his term. He's then reelected a number of years later in 2000, and he's not allowed to finish up out his term. He again tries to make this the mildest of changes in these structures that have been put in place over several centuries. And he's removed from power in another U.S. invasion. This time the Marines literally arrive in Port-au-Prince, in the capital of Haiti, and remove him and send him into exile into Africa. When you ask about First and Third World, you're really asking about how this world capitalist system came into being and how the vanquished became the Third World and how the victors became the First World and how these relations of domination, these global power relations, are being sustained right up and through to the 21st century.
We Americans are always at our best when we hear and heed the cries of others.
When confronted with massive human suffering, Americans have always stepped up and answered the call to help.
But there's never been anything on a scale of human tragedy in our own hemisphere like what we're now witnessing in Haiti.
Today, President Clinton and I are joining together to appeal to you with real urgency.
Give now, and lives will be saved. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bill Clinton and George Bush would later help to organize relief efforts after a disastrous earthquake struck Haiti in 2010. Yet, if it weren't for the actions of Clinton and Bush while in office, the Haitian people may have been able to create infrastructure that would have significantly reduced the terrible human toll of the earthquake. As it turned out, the aid itself was grossly insufficient. As with Serbia, and more recently Libya, events in Haiti were sold to the public as humanitarian intervention. This technique has long been used as a justification for imperialism. Originally, the idea was to civilize the savages, then to promote what was termed democracy. In the early 20th century, General Smedley Butler described with remarkable candor his actual role in the U.S. Army. "I helped make Mexico, especially Tampico, safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenues in. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefits of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1909 to 1912. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. In China, I helped to see to it that Standard Oil went its way unmolested." Butler summed up his message with four simple words: "War is a racket." Perhaps the greatest propaganda feat in modern history has been the profound ignorance of the American public of the atrocities committed in their name. This did not occur by accident. Diplomatic historian Richard Immerman observes of President Eisenhower that he took it as an article of faith that America's strength and security depended on its maintaining access to, indeed control of, global markets and resources, particularly in the Third World. He also notes that Eisenhower rejected the notion of an international communist conspiracy as the product of paranoid imagination. Unfortunately for the American public, a paranoid imagination was exactly what Cold War propagandists desired in their target audience. John Foster Dulles, brother of CIA Director Alan Dulles, proclaimed after World War II that, "In order to make the country bear the burden, we have to create an emotional atmosphere akin to wartime psychology. We must create the idea of a threat from without." Senator Arthur Vandenberg was more blunt. In 1947, he advised President Truman to, quote, "scare the hell out of the American people." And that's exactly what they proceeded to do.
There's a succinct and pointed quote from General Douglas MacArthur: "Our country is now geared to an arms economy, which was bred in an artificially induced psychosis of war hysteria and nurtured upon an incessant propaganda of fear." Following recordings from October the 30th, 1938, from the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Ladies and gentlemen, here is the latest bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News, Trenton, New Jersey. It is reported that at 8:50 p.m., a huge flaming object, believed to be a meteorite, fell on a farm in the neighborhood of Grover's Mill, New Jersey, 22 miles from Trenton. We have dispatched a special mobile unit to the scene. We take you now to Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Carl Phillips again, out at the Wilmot Farm, Grover's Mill, New Jersey. I guess that's it. Something's happening. Ladies and gentlemen, this is terrific. The top is beginning to rotate like a screw, and this thing must be hollow.
He's moving!
Gentlemen, it's indescribable. I can hardly force myself to keep looking at it. It's alive and dripping from its rimless lips. It seems to quiver and pulsate, and the monster or whatever it is can hardly move. It seems weighed down by possibly gravity or something. Wait a minute, something's happening. A humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? Jet of flame springs in the mirror and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. The whole field's caught up by the woods of fires. The gas tanks of the automobiles spreading everywhere, coming this way now.
It is perhaps the single most famous radio broadcast in human history. The night before Halloween in 1938, thousands of people became panicked when Orson Welles interrupted a regularly scheduled program to broadcast a fictitious news account of alien invaders. Though many listeners found the idea of an alien invasion ridiculous, they were equally frightened at the prospect that Germans were invading under the guise of little gray men. One of the reasons for the effectiveness of the broadcast was Welles's use of late-breaking news bulletins, which audiences associated with updates of Nazi aggression in Europe.
In fact, I know they were. That texture was closer. What do you think, Mr. Wilson?
What they have come to consider, I'm quite surprised that the H.G. Wells classic, which is the original for many fantasies about invasions by mythical monsters from the planet Mars, I'm extremely surprised to learn that a story which has become familiar to children through the medium of comic strips and many succeeding novels and adventure stories should have had such an immediate and profound effect upon radio listeners.
The public's response to the broadcast was of intense interest to communication theorists and social psychologists. One example was the Princeton Office of Radio Research, established by a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation. It created a 10-page interview questionnaire given to several study groups. The data was used to write a report entitled Invasion from Mars, a Study in the Psychology of Panic.
It was studied up one wall and down the other by various social scientists trying to get a handle on what is the impact of radio broadcasting, and most particularly, what is the impact of fear in radio broadcasting? To what extent are either individuals or crowds of people affected by things they hear on the radio? This was of intense interest in the United States. It's important to keep in mind that over across the ocean, during exactly that same time period, the Nazis had come to power in Germany. Goebbels, who was a propaganda minister, was highly effective at using radio to shape crowds, to shape political movements, this type of thing. The common thread, though, is that political elites in both countries were deeply interested in how to use the medium to advance their own interests. And if you step back and think about it, this is not a particularly radical point of view or radical analysis. This is pretty much the way the world works. Elites in the United States responded in different ways. It's because on the one hand, they were worried that if crowds of people took things into their own hands, quote-unquote, that would be dangerous. On the other hand, it in some ways provided great promise because it held out the possibility is that if you could figure out how to turn that key, then the crowds would do what you wanted them to do.
If the War of the Worlds broadcast demonstrated the power of radio to instill terror in the public, it was the Nuremberg rallies that would perform the same function for the moving image. The idea for the rallies came from Ernst Hansstengel, who had previously attended Harvard University and written several songs for Harvard's football team. Hansstengel proposed using Harvard pep rallies as models for a demonstration of Nazi solidarity. What emerged was an awesome display of obedience to power. In 1934, filmmaker Leni Riefenstahl chronicled one of the mass spectacles in her film, Triumph des Willens, or Triumph of the Will. Her artful techniques earned acclaim not only from propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels, but film critics throughout the world. Ultimately, however, Ms. Riefenstahl's work presents but one piece of the Nazi puzzle.
Weltanschauungskrieg is German, and it means worldview warfare. The activists who were most committed to Nazi principles would confront other parts of the society and say, well, you have the wrong worldview. So this worldview warfare was a way in which they went about consolidating their hold on German society, in Nazifying universities, in Nazifying companies, or cultural institutions, or churches. That was worldview warfare. You could call it propaganda, but it wasn't propaganda in the narrow sense of the term, like simply radio broadcasts or something. This is not just publicity. This is not just persuasion in the sense of what somebody on radio has to say. This is a whole range of techniques, from religious or pseudo-religious techniques, evangelism, to exploiting the psychology of fear, to exploiting tensions between races and ethnic groups, use of terror, use of violence. It's a whole range of applied manipulation of people. When war finally did break out between Nazi Germany and the United States, while Bill Donovan, who was a Wall Street guy, who was great friends with the president, who was strongly anti-Nazi German, he was not a pro-Nazi ideologue, but he looked at what the Nazis were doing with this worldview warfare. He believed that it was successful, and so he tried to come up with an American version of the same sort of thing. So that while the Nazis would appeal to German pride, German racial pride, while Bill Donovan attempted to apply to American pride, Americanism, without such an explicit racial component. For example, the Nazi version would appeal to a desire for a strong leader. The American version would appeal to a desire for a legitimate leader, some sort of national consent, national unity, and so on. So I'm not saying that these are the same things. What I'm saying is that these are two different approaches to a single problem, or to a similar problem.
There's black and white images of workers clearing things up, out with the old, in with the new. We've grown used to our places of work, factories and building sites, looking ugly and filthy. Our workplaces should be beautiful and worthy of us. This is no superficial matter. Entrepreneurs must recognize that even more important than a factory's machines are its people. It's a question of a new lease of life. It concerns creative German people's joy in their work. There's a black and white shot of Germans jumping around energetically, giving each other Nazi-style salutes and getting ready for work. Suddenly jumps to a 1950s Technicolor shot of more rows of young bodies, this time American in appearance, engaged in suspiciously similar types of activities.
We are shareholders in the greatest enterprise on Earth, the United States of America Unlimited. Our strength lies in the character of our people, young in heart, independent in thought and nature, skilled of hand. American enterprise has harnessed fire and water, wind, sun, and soil to produce an abundance of everything.
During the Cold War and beyond, the moving image would transmit the American Weltanschauungskrieg to millions of citizens through small flickering screens.
John Stauber from the Center for Media and Democracy.
Well, television is the perfect propaganda medium because television really appeals to emotion. And it's a very powerful medium. People, see something on television, we actually internalize it. If you grew up in the 50s and somebody says, what did you think of Ward Cleaver? You know, anyone who watched television can imagine, we can picture in our minds, Ward Cleaver is the father of young Beaver and Leave It to Beaver as clearly as we can see our own parents.
You know, Dad, it's funny.
What's funny?
Well, whenever we cook inside, Mom always does the cooking. But whenever we cook outside, you always do it. How come?
Well, it's sort of traditional, I guess. They say a woman's place is in the home, and I suppose as long as she's in the home, she might as well be in the kitchen.
I would say that the TV news has shown itself to be probably the worst source of information across the board. And there have been some interesting studies that document this. I mean, for one thing, if you ever look at transcripts from TV news programs, they always look sort of weird without the visuals. And sometimes it's even hard to really get the gist of the story. You sort of need the whole gestalt. But the first thing you notice is that there's very little information actually imparted in TV news. It's not a long script. But after that first Gulf War, for instance, the University of Massachusetts Amherst did a study to see how public opinion was affected by news coverage of the war. And what they found was that people who watched the most coverage of the first Gulf War were convinced that they knew the most about the war, were the most likely to support the U.S. war to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. But an actual test, when asked to give factual responses to questions about the war, actually tended to know the least and get the most information wrong.
When it came to foreign policy in the post-war era, there was one central theme. The Russians were coming.
Some will get through to your home.
This, our country and all its people, could be in danger of nuclear attack.
It can't happen here. Well, this is what it looks like.
The light flash and the heat wave, then the blast tears away part of each roof. Let's see it again in stop motion.
We're here already!
It's a happy-go-spending world, reflected in the windows of the suburban shopping centers where they go to buy.
At least as important as news programming in molding public opinion has been the motion picture. Though Hollywood is popularly regarded as a left-wing conspiracy, the movie industry has always had an ambivalent relationship with power. During World War I, moving images were used to mobilize the public in support of war. During World War II, the trend continued, but with considerably more star power. In 1956, the Joint Chiefs of Staff met with John Ford, John Wayne, and Marion Cooper to brainstorm the subject of what they called militant liberty. By the time Top Gun was released in 1986, the American Navy was setting up recruiting booths outside theaters. The Pentagon routinely loans out military hardware to film projects. Here are a few recent examples.
Armageddon, 1998.
United States government just asked us to save the world.
Beam me up, Scotty.
Air Force One, 1997.
In a speech tonight in Moscow, the president issued a direct challenge to terrorist nations around the world.
But the question remains, what are the risks involved in such a bold policy?
Iron Man, 2008.
For your consideration, the chair.
Sir Ridley Scott's Black Hawk Down was given similar support. This might help to explain why the character of John Grimes is not shown raping a 12-year-old Somali girl as he did during the mission portrayed in the film.
Nobody asks to be a hero. She sometimes turns out that way.
Equally revealing are films that were turned down by the Pentagon.
Apocalypse Now, 1979.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
Platoon, 1986. Full Metal Jacket, 1987. The Thin Red Line, 1998. Doctor Strangelove, 1964.
I can no longer sit back and allow communist infiltration, communist indoctrination, communist subversion, and the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Under the Third Reich, Joseph Goebbels advanced a theory that media should be uniform in principle, but polyform in nuances. In this manner, the illusion of plurality and openness could be maintained, when in fact, the same basic message was being broadcast from all frequencies.
Party comrades, a good government can no more exist without propaganda than good propaganda without a good government.
In the United States, dissident voices would be tolerated, but at the same time marginalized by what became known as the mainstream media. During the 1950s, Soviets themselves marveled at the uniformity of American public opinion.
Morris Berman, author of Dark Ages America.
After Stalin's death in the 50s, there was a thaw and in a detente in relationships between the Soviet Union and the United States. And during that time, I don't know, about 24 apparatchiki were invited from the Soviet Union to come to the United States for a couple of weeks and run free. Just look at all our institutions. The Senate, just go to debates in the Senate, Supreme Court, high schools, anywhere they wanted to go, newspapers, see what our institutions are like. And at the end of that, they got them all together. And of course, they were very excited because the idea was to show the Soviets what a truly pluralistic society was. The response they got was a little different than the one they expected. What the Soviet apparatchiki said to them was, how do you do it? How do you have you created such a degree of conformity that everybody repeats the same thing over and over again? Well, you know, the Americans weren't too happy. American politicians weren't too happy with this answer. But it's largely the truth. There isn't very much of a spectrum of opinion. And so what you have is people believing that Democrat and Republican parties, for example, are fundamentally different. Whereas the truth is, to quote Gore Vidal, what you've got is one political party with two right wings. I mean, these are differences in style, not differences in substance. But Americans get very excited about these minor differences. What's going on, then, is this brainwashing.
Peter Phillips from Project Censored.
Well, certainly corporate media today is very similar to, in terms of presenting stories that support the government, like Pravda was under the Soviet Union. The difference is that the people in Russia, they knew that Pravda was an organ of the state. And in the United States, we don't have to, we still think it's a free press. And essentially, the corporate media is in the entertainment business, so most of content is just kind of keeping us updates on personalities or movie stars or scary events, you know, some terrible crime somewhere that gets, you know, broadcast all over the country. Very little analysis in terms of working people or what the powerful are doing, what kind of decisions they're making. The same way in the Soviet Union. I mean, the Pravda wasn't exposing Communist Party or corruption inside of it. They just weren't able to do that. And in the U.S., you might get a single person identified, but you don't look at it systematically or, right. or the problems that are addressed in terms of class structure or race or gender problems in a major way.
Nancy Snow, author of Propaganda, Inc.
It almost comes full circle back to Edward Bernays and to Walter Lippmann, because these were men, again, who were the founders in many respects of my discipline in communications and journalism and public relations. But they all really touted the need to have a professional managerial intelligentsia, the best and the brightest, who knew better than the rest of us, that the masses as a whole were just not smart enough, were driven more by impulse and emotion, and what Walter Lippmann called they were a bewildered herd. You can't trust the people as a whole, so you have to create a very small elite. So you wonder now, and looking back, was the Cold War just this perpetuation of controlling people's minds in order to really benefit this minority elite class?
To help us understand why the message conveyed through American media in the post-war era was so remarkably uniform, it is useful to examine exactly who was controlling the message. During World War II, the field of psychological warfare grew from a minor component in the government's arsenal to a flagship weapon. Yet this weapon was not deactivated after the war. Many key personnel from World War II PSYOPs divisions went on to play major roles in the allegedly free and independent American press.
The country has been demobilized, at least to some extent, after the war. What happens? Leading lights in the OSS, for example, included the publishers of Life magazine, key editorial people in Reader's Digest, Time Life, William Paley, president of CBS, he was a OSS man during the war and worked specifically with the psychological warfight of the U.S. effort in World War II. He goes back to Wall Street and is president of CBS. And CBS then, under his leadership, works closely, hand in glove, with what were CIA propaganda operations, such as Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and so forth. And with basically both the overt and the clandestine side of U.S. military operations throughout the Vietnam period and later. Edward Barrett, who was chief of Psi War during the early 1950s, he was a noteworthy media figure in his own right. He later became the dean of the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. There are many other examples along these lines, and what it points to, and you can read this in their memoirs, is a network of people whose relationship was forged during World War II and in a common political warfare effort against a specific enemy, Nazi Germany or Imperial Japan, that took that sensibility about media being able to operate both in war and peace, and use that and forge that as the mainstream media in the United States in the wake of World War II.
The U.S. House Intelligence Hearing in 1975.
Do you have any people being paid by the CIA who are contributing to a major circulation American journal?
We do have people who submit pieces to two American journals.
Do you have any people paid by the CIA who are working for television networks?
This, I think, gets into the kind of getting into the details, Mr. Chairman, that I'd like to get into in executive session.
Do you have any people being paid by the CIA who are contributing to the National News Services, AP and UPI?
Well, again, I think we're getting into the kind of detail, Mr. Chairman, that I'd prefer to handle in executive session.
One of the most important figures in the new media empire was Henry Luce, the founder of Time magazine. An early supporter of fascism and a member of the elite secret society Skull and Bones, Luce had written in 1941 of an American century in which the United States had the right to exert upon the world the full impact of our influence for such purposes as we see fit and by such means as we see fit.
Foreign big business was weakened during the war, and today American big business is the strongest. And they have a dream. To dominate the world. They call their dream the American century. The American century means the century of big business instead of the century of the common people.
After the fall of the Soviet Union, Luce's theory would be rebranded as the Project for a New American Century. The latter document laid out a program for full spectrum dominance of the U.S. military across the entire planet. Following in Luce's footsteps was C.D. Jackson, who had served as deputy chief at the Psychological Warfare Division at Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force. After the war, Jackson became managing director of Time Life International. According to journalist Carl Bernstein of Watergate fame, Jackson was Henry Luce's personal emissary to the CIA. Jackson would play a significant role in what became known as Operation Mockingbird, a blatantly unconstitutional program by the new intelligence agency to buy influence at major media outlets. Media assets were created at ABC, NBC, CBS, Associated Press, Reuters, Hearst Newspapers, Scripps Howard, and virtually every other major news organization.
Sig Mikkelsen, president of CBS News from 1954 to 1961.
We had been contacted by the CIA. As a matter of fact, by the time I became the head of the whole news and public affairs operation in 1954,
ships had been established.
Bernstein reported in 1977 that for over 25 years, more than 400 U.S. reporters had willingly carried out intelligence assignments for the CIA.
Russ Baker, journalist.
The very important critiques of the corporate media and how it functions as an institution, as part of the establishment, need to be supplemented by an understanding of the role of infiltration of the media itself. These are not mutually exclusive, and so while on the one hand you certainly have the institutional problems with a media owned by wealthy, powerful people deciding what information we ought to have, but on another level you actually have this operational capacity in which intelligence agencies have infiltrated and influenced people within the media, within the reporting ranks themselves. There are many, many examples of this. Even Carl Bernstein of the famed Woodward and Bernstein duo wrote an article after he left the Post documenting the role of the intelligence agencies in putting people into news organizations, including the Washington Post, Newsweek, and many other of the brand names.
If you look at the relationship between media organizations and national security agencies in the early Cold War years and in the early 1950s, the characteristic was there are two different bodies of people, two different groups, but they had a common mission in mind, a common conception of what patriotism was, common conception of what the enemy was, and so forth and so on. And so it was really rather simple for CIA agents to go to their old buddies and say, look, the country needs you, and here's what we need you to do. Or alternately, if one of their buddies in the media was getting too out of line as to the discussion of, well, what should U.S. policy about Yugoslavia be, or other Cold War era controversies of that sort, to have a meeting with them and sit down and say, look, we think you're out of line and you're doing this bad thing because you're raising this and this question, and we think that you should not do that. So there was that type of social pressure and cooperation. Okay, let's fast forward to the present day. That same type of relationship does still exist.
PBS NewsHour, April 24th, 2008.
What happened here was a PSYOPs campaign, an incredible government propaganda campaign whereby Donald Rumsfeld and Tory Clark, the head of public relations for the Pentagon, designed a program to recruit at least 75 former military officers, as your report said, most of them now lobbyists or consultants to military contractors, and insert them beginning in 2002, before the attack on Iraq was even launched, into the major networks to manage the messages, to be surrogates, and that's the words that are actually used, message multipliers for the Secretary of Defense and for the Pentagon.
And
this program continues right up to now.
And is the essence of this that what they did was what the Pentagon did was illegal?
Yes, what they did was illegal. Now, the Pentagon might contest that, but we've had various laws on the books in our country going back to the 1920s. It is illegal for the U.S. government to propagandize citizens in this way. In my opinion, this war could have never been sold if it were not for this sophisticated propaganda campaign. And what we need is congressional investigation of not just this Pentagon military analyst program, but all the rest of the deception and propaganda that came out of the Bush administration and out of the Pentagon that allowed them to sell and manage this war.
And well, we want to keep this, for the purposes of this discussion, focused on this particular report.
and the war in Iraq goes forward for 3, 4, 5 years, before questions that were obvious even before the war began to be discussed in the public debate.
Illustrating the shared mindset between the state and elite media institutions was Katharine Graham, who led the Washington Post for over 2 decades. In a 1988 speech given to senior CIA employees at agency headquarters, she remarked, "We live in a dirty and dangerous world. There are some things the general public does not need to know and shouldn't. I believe democracy flourishes when the government can take legitimate steps to keep its secrets and when the press can decide whether to print what it knows." Meanwhile, the military was conducting its own experiments in public opinion, military mobilization, propaganda, and related fields. Approximately $1 billion a year was spent on these endeavors, an incredible amount for the time period. One of the most revealing internal propaganda efforts was Project Revere. It entailed the dropping of millions of leaflets by American bombers, not over a newly occupied territory, but over Washington State, Idaho, Montana, Utah, and Alabama.
To have airplanes drop leaflets in Louisiana and in the northern states of the United States saying, essentially, warning, this could be a bomb, this could be a Russian bomb. We need to have people to sign up for watch centers that will watch the skies for Russian bombers, and in this way we will protect ourselves. Call such and such a number and you can join this team. And they would dump millions of these leaflets on rural communities and small towns in these areas of the country. And then the scholars would go in there and see, well, how many people called the watch center? And what happened when kids picked it up? Did the kids take the leaflet to their parents, or did the kids just throw it away? If a parent picked it up, did they take it to their church or school or business, or did they just keep it at home? And so this was all studied out. This was both a propaganda, it was a study of how propaganda works, and it was also a propaganda event in its own right, and that was aimed at the American public at the height of the Cold War with a message of potential fear and devastation to see how they would respond. The realities of warfare at that time were that Russian planes could not reach Europe often, much less the United States. They simply did not have that capability, the technically capability, and the military organizations knew it. But nevertheless, the projected fear of war was used to eventually push the bomber gap into becoming a major political issue of the era and a major source of funding for the agencies that were running this propaganda study in the United States.
William Bloom, historian.
Continuously, the American elite had to keep the American public frightened about foreign enemies, in this case communism, and the American Congress had to also be kept intimidated. There was always some gap they could point to between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. There was in some sequence or other, a bomber gap, a laser gap, and a missile gap. There was always some gap, which if we didn't fill in and overcome, would lead to a terrible war where we would be at a great disadvantage. That was the idea behind these gap warnings. So there was always had to be some warning of some great danger abroad. And of course, that has not changed at all today.
Let there be no doubt. America is determined to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, and I will take no options off the table to achieve that goal.
And we believe he has, in fact, reconstituted nuclear weapons.
No question, we have said that Saddam Hussein possesses biological and chemical weapons.
We know where they are. They're in the area around Tikrit and Baghdad.
Donald Rumsfeld, U.S. Secretary of Defense.